Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and on the web at kfai.org. Radio without boundaries.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at kfai.org, non-commercial community powered radio. Stay tuned for the Filipino American National News.
On a rainy Sunday morning,
magandang gabi sa inyong lahat, and welcome to the Filipino American National News. On this evening's show, we have a very special guest, a very talented individual. We have none other than Jet Tolentino, who is a three-time Tony Award-winning Grammy Award winner, who is making his feature film debut as a director with the film Asian Persuasion, which releases on Friday, March the 21st. Welcome to the show, Jet.
Hey, Alan. Thank you for having me.
You've had this illustrious career. What sparked you into getting into the world of film?
Oh, yeah. I think this came about in 2021 when I got hold of the script. In 2021 was my 10th year anniversary in commercial producing. And prior to that, I started thinking of something else that I could evolve to in the entertainment industry. I didn't quite know what that was yet until this very script was presented to me. And here we are.
And it is quite a process in terms of getting a film made. How did the concept of Asian Persuasion make its way to yourself?
Yeah, well, it started as anything else. It's like in any project, it starts with a concept, right? So Mike Ang, the screenwriter, has been a friend of mine for years. And he approached me this back in 2021 and told me that he wrote a script. And I, of course, I couldn't believe it because Mike is a civil engineer by profession. And he said, "This is the kind of thing that I'd like my divorce should have gone this way." So he fictionalized everything. And I thought, all right, let me take a look at that. Although in the beginning, I turned him down right away because I've been busy with my projects. And then he came home with a nagging thought to let me know that I crushed his very first elevator pitch. And I felt bad. And he said, "You know, we're friends, right? So you have to read my script." So there you go. He used his friend card, and I know what that means. And I did. And 2 weeks later, when I finished the script, I texted him and I said, "Done. We have to talk." And then he Ubered an adobo meal from Bloomfield, New Jersey to Jackson Heights, where I am. And we discussed his script over lunch. And I told him about my initial thoughts, and you know, surprisingly, he's okay with that. And after 8 revisions, we came up with a pretty solid script. And as a producer, I thought, who should I give this to as a director? And that sort of, because I mean, Asian Persuasion, and knowing Mike, if you've met him or if you've heard of him somewhere, he has this twisted sense of humor. I call it twisted, but he means well. And again, the script has strong languages from both sexes. And I thought, me being gay and in the middle, I don't think anybody would question my intention and how I present the project.
Well, if I ever have a project to pitch to you, Jet, I'll definitely use the Filipino guilt card and food as a way to persuade you.
Right? Yeah.
When you saw this initial script by him, what things stood out to you about his initial draft to you?
Well, to me, the title by itself is very striking. I didn't even suggest to change it or to, you know, name another title, because in 2021 also, it was the height of late winter. Early spring of 2021 was the height of Asian hate. So, and again, coming from the Broadway space, that's, I haven't really much done, you know, for AAPI projects. And I thought it was striking to me right off the bat. And then I read the script. And of course, it's a very New York story. And I can identify where the characters are coming from. Right. So I wanted it to come from an authentic space. And I thought I'd throw my hat to direct it.
In regards to directing a film, it's quite a process. Some might say it takes years sometimes to get a film made, but you were able to get this film made. You spoke of Asian hate, but before Asian hate was going on, unfortunately, you're also dealing with COVID on top of this.
Yeah.
First, before we get to the topic of COVID, how quickly from the time that Mike submitted the work to you to finding financial backing for Asian Persuasion?
Yeah, so timeline wise, we decided to lock the script by late March of 2021. And then we were off to the races and, you know, finding investors. And again, I come from a commercial space on Broadway where all my 18 projects were private equity. So I don't really go to grants, because I thought I would just give that to other artists who could use that. Because I know I can finance my projects based on, you know, my body of work and my relationship. So I was pretty confident in funding the film. So probably by October of 2021, we reached a threshold of $1 million. So that's when I greenlit the project. And then, you know, and then we started pre-production in February of 2022. And the first principal photography happened on April 11th, 2022. And we finished on May 18th, 2022. And world premiered at the Soho International Film Festival in September 2023.
Such a quick turnaround there, Jet. So kudos in terms of what you've accomplished. I think
it's sort of like a pressure because my name is Jet, you know, so anything has to be
nothing can be slow
or fast. Exactly.
And with your film, we see the involvement of longtime in terms of media production of ABS-CBN and Mix. Why was it important for them to be involved in your project?
Well, ABS-CBN is probably the biggest media that Philippines has ever had or still has, right? Even if they've moved to digital now, they still have this huge presence, not just in the Philippines, but all over the world. Because, you know, Philippines is the only country in the world with 10% of its population reside outside of the country. So Filipinos are always thirsty or nostalgic on whatever news from the homeland. And my relationship with ABS started early on, where they've heard about me, about the Broadway shows. And the first film that I pitched to them, which unfortunately they passed. Well, maybe that's the one. They regretted it. And then I presented Asian Persuasion, and without even reading the script of Asian Persuasion, they said, of course. So that was the start. And it was, you know, strategic of me approaching them because I want them to be a part of this film, because there are 4.6 million Filipino Americans in the United States, you know, about 6 million, including Canada. So this is a big market, and, you know, it works for strategy, and I used my relationship on that.
And just to remind you to our listeners and our viewers, we have director Jet Tolentino, who is the director of Asian Persuasion. What I find fascinating about your film in terms of casting is, many times for Asian Americans, males, they don't always have the most positive or seen in the most, I guess, quote unquote, masculine, macho of way. And two of the actors that you have here, luckily in their career, especially early on in their career, they've been able to play strong Asian American male characters, love interests, in fact. Getting to have the likes of Dante Bosco and Paulo Montalban, how did they get involved with your film?
Yeah, we got our OGs, right? Dante from Hook and Paulo Montalban from Cinderella. Yeah, well, the two have been friends of mine. Starting with Paulo, I've been friends with Paulo for over a decade. We used to watch Broadway shows together, if he's not in a show. Because there's very few Phil-Ams in New York anyway. And, you know, we did that. And then Dante, I met him in 2017 at the world premiere of my short documentary, Life is What You Make It, at the inaugural Cinematografo Film Festival in San Francisco. And we became friends since. And out of the 28 speaking roles in Asian Persuasion, only two were casted by our casting director. 26 were from personal relationships. So, and Paulo was the first one to say yes. And he actually asked me after reading the script, he was like, Jet, does Mike know about my life? I said, why'd you ask? He was like, well, he wrote about me. I'm 47, I'm socially awkward, I have no game with women, and so this is me. So I was like, I guarantee you Mike doesn't know you. But this is a pure coincidence. So, but yeah, so he gravitated towards this script, and here we are. And if you've seen the movie, he's such a darling to watch, right? And of course, Dante also coming from a villainous hook to be the lead in a rom-com. So, and it's somewhat serious and dramatic role. Yeah, it paid off.
The only tease that I know that I can give without seeing your film is that if people are aware of Filipino-American entertainment over the last 30 years, there's a bit of an Easter egg cameo in your film. So that's all I'm going to say to some people out there. That's how I found out about your film. So we also have some mutual friends. So that's all I'm going to tell our audience, that there'll be somebody there of significance in the film that you'll be like, oh...
Yeah, there's quite a few of them, actually. There's quite a few of them. So, yeah, don't look for them. I mean, prior to seeing the movie, because, yeah, we've announced it somewhere. But, you know, just come in and be surprised who you'd like to see and if you can identify them.
You have spoke about the strong influence strong women have had on you. Mm-hmm. In the film, you have employed many women on this production, and you've also made the conscious decision of employing Asian Americans on this film. Why was it important for you to do this with this project?
Yeah, as I was thriving on Broadway, artists from home, they started messaging me and asking me if I can do something for them and if I could be the conduit for them to cross over. So that really spoke to me. And I reflected on the trajectory of my career. And of course, the Asian Hate happened. And I made a conscious decision to, moving forward, I'll make whatever I do in my career to be AAPI-centric. And with Asian Persuasion, it probably my proudest moment is having 10 female Asian filmmakers to be head of departments. And none of those 10 women were ever ahead of the department. You know, they've been in the film industry for over 10 years. But, you know, other productions would have them as production assistant or second in command, but never really the deciding hat. So that was one of my major joys coming off of this. And again, I mean, and the general thought of, you know, if we don't create opportunities for our people, nobody will. So we got to do it ourselves.
And we spoke of earlier of how during the production of this, COVID reared its ugly head. How did COVID affect the production of your film?
Well, second day, this is fun fact, well, maybe not funny, haha. But on the second day, my script supervisor, because that was the very person next to me while directing. And then I turned around, as I could recognize that it's not her anymore. And it was like, who are you? <It's> like, I'm the replacement, because, you know. So the scripts, because we tested 3 times a week, right? So, and we wouldn't be able to start until all the tests have been cleared. And sure enough, the second day, she was yanked out so fast. So I got a different script for the next few days. And then, but I think the biggest impact was on day 16, when one of our lead actors got COVID, and it happened in our most expensive location at the Museum of Modern Moving Image in Queens, you know. So we rented the entire museum for the day to shoot. So it was just for our access. So before we started filming, of course, we had to do the test, and one of the lead actors got COVID, and, you know, quietly she was pulled out. And one of the great cameos flew in from LA just to have the scene with this actor, and now I can't do it. So I had to come up with 2 new scenes that were not in the script just to save our rental, because the rental fee is non-refundable. And then once we finished that, and when the actor was better 12 days later, so we had to go back to the Museum of the Moving Image and rent it again for the whole day. So that was that. So the COVID by itself cost us an extra $100,000 that was not on our budget. So that was, yeah, that was the big impact.
And in your film, we see that one of the other main characters is played by actress Casey Concepcion. How did Casey become a part of the production?
Well, it's been reported before that she was not the original Avery Chua, right? Because we had one, but then 2 weeks before our pre-production, she had a conflict with the Philippine election. So, you know, and I panicked because her management decided that she couldn't do the project anymore. So I called Sharon Cuneta right away, and because like Casey has been on my list, but I haven't met her before. So I called Sharon and asked, where's your daughter? She was like, she's in LA studying gemology. So I thought, oh, okay. So I told Sharon, just please tell her that I messaged her on Instagram, and if she could just check it and get back to me. And the next day, I Zoomed with Casey. I sent her the script. And then a few more days, we discussed it, and she's in. So she flew to New York. And, you know, I'm glad that she did, because, you know, it's, I think with the original actor that I had in mind, might have been a different film. So, you know, everything happens for a reason, and for the right reasons, that is. So, Yeah. And
as you said, everything happens for a reason. You spoke about how Mike is a civil engineer. You didn't necessarily begin, I guess, a career in theater or in film, that you had a different path before you even got into this, that you're like, you worked in the world of, I guess, financed on some level. Mm-hmm. How does this journey begin, Jet?
Oh my God. I don't know how much time do you have, but, well, you know, to make it short, yes, I have an accounting degree. I've worked in Hong Kong in finance. I've worked in a Japanese firm as an internal auditor there. Then I moved to the US because of that connection, because, you know, I just wanted to realize something in my life. I've always wanted to be a flight attendant, but you know, in the Philippines, they have a height requirement for men, which is 5'8", and I'm 5'5", so I missed that. And I thought I'd explore that in the United States. And when my job concluded at The Good Guys, I don't know, you know, people from the West, if you're familiar with The Good Guys, that was my first job in the US. And my training was in Oakland, California for sales and marketing. And I was selling high definition camcorders and television sets. And, you know, well, in the showroom, of course, I had to watch movies all the time and all that. And then when The Good Guys was absorbed by Radio Shack, I had an option, you know, what to do next. So I applied to Southwest Airlines. I thought, all right, I'll try this if I could be a flight attendant. And I was accepted. I was going to go to Houston, but then to Dallas for training. Then a friend of mine in New Jersey asked me if I was still looking for a job, that their mortgage company has an opening. So I just sent my resume and I was asked if I could come in for an interview. You know, there was no Zoom then. That was 2004. So I flew to New York. I gave up the chance to be a flight attendant because I always wanted to get to New York anyway. And I got the job. And 3 months later, I was promoted into a commercial mortgage and, you know, with an office on the 55th floor of the Empire State Building. And then of course that, and then the financial collapse happened and I couldn't find any job in the finance world. So I went to a job placement agency on Times Square for anything. And they asked me if I could do like an executive assistant job to a wealthy individual. I said, okay, what does it take? You know, what's entailed to be that person? So they told me, and, you know, I worked for this particular wealthy individual who had four multiple homes. So I had to be with him all the time, manage the household, the staff and all that. And that was great. And I became a fly in the wall from the wealthy living. I experienced it firsthand, a jet set, private jet setting and all that. Until, you know, he died and that took a toll on me. And then I went back to the agency and they gave me another Jewish rich person to take care of. And he died also. I was like, okay, this is enough. So while doing those jobs, executive assistants or nursing assistants, that was my day job. And at nighttime, I would go to Broadway to watch Broadway shows. So that's where it started. You know, it's New York. They say you are a true New Yorker if you have three things, right? An accountant, a lawyer, and a shrink. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I consider Broadway as my shrink because I love the idea of going in, lights out, and I transport to, and I can identify with the characters that I'm watching on stage or someone that I know. And it's like a self-check for me. Had I reacted or behaved the right way? So I love that process until I just realized I've been going 3 to 5 times a week, you know, and after having seen over 1,000 shows, I became jaded and I started advocating for Broadway to just produce quality shows. And that was the start. And I've been invited to workshop presentations, readings, previews, even opening nights. So I didn't have to pay for my tickets on Broadway. And then I met those people who I panned in my reviews, and some of them don't have a sense of humor. So, you know, and I felt bad because I thought, one, they would never find me. And so my frustration grew because, like, I didn't know that my words affect artists, right? So, and at my boss at that time saw my frustration. He was like, what's wrong with you? You have a finance degree. You know, you've been seeing Broadway. I think you, why don't you start? You know, we start this, you pick the shows and I write the check. So that was the start. In 18 shows later, 3 Tonys and a Grammy, that was that. So that's, you know, in a nutshell. And now I'm focusing on films.
We talk about how you admire strong women. And we mm-hmm. I would be remiss if I didn't ask about, you were able to work with probably one of the strongest, maybe one of the most powerful women out there in Oprah Winfrey when you worked with her yeah. on The Color Purple. What was that like to, I'm going to guess that she was a hero before working with her. As, yeah. How was she as a person?
Work-wise, we didn't really, you know, we were not hands-on because there are different types of producers, right? She produced the Broadway show. So she got the Tony for that, for the revival. I produced the album. So we did not get to work directly together because she was not on the album, but we've met a few times during the run of The Color Purple, of course. You know, of course we say we belong to the same team. But it's true, whatever you've heard, that she's quite humble, you know, no ego whatsoever, because I guess people who really come from hardships or, you know, poverty, they or I consider one of them, you know, we wear our hearts on our sleeves. So we're more empathetic to what people go through because we went through it ourselves. Yeah.
And before we come to the end of the interview, Jen, one of the things I find fascinating just by watching the trailer is that you have characters of death. You have Casey as a woman who's pursuing her career. And then you kind of have men also, not necessarily in terms of how they're portrayed in film, on a more of subordinate type of role, at least for Dante in the film, where he wasn't the one who was essentially chasing his dream at first. Why was it essential for you guys to have these characters of depth to the characters of Asian Persuasion?
Well, short answer is it boils down to representation, right? Because this particular story could happen to any race. It's about divorce. It's about parenthood. It's about, well, not just parenthood, but I want to highlight this very smart kid that they have that were portrayed by Scarlett. I'm blanking at her name. Scarlett Scher, you know, beautifully portrayed by Scarlett Scher, this smart kid, and who really is an observant in the scenario in the family home. But she gets it. She gets where her parents are coming from, and she supports that they have to be separated because they can't coexist. It's not that you don't love each other, but that. So you got the parenting, and you got the internal conversations between sexes. Right, so we are letting anyone lean in and have a closer look on the Asian culture and how we speak about current events, pop culture, and even politics was mentioned there. So they know that we're no different than other races. We're just here to coexist, and that we belong here too.
The fascinating thing about you with your success with the Tonys is that when it comes to Philippine-born winners of Tonys, there only is really two people as far as I know, maybe three, but the two that come to light is yourself and Leia Salonga. Yeah. Did you ever think in a million years that your name would be uttered with Leia Salonga as Tony Award winners?
No. And for those who are listening, if you're curious how, if you'd like to know how would that look like, just go on YouTube and type Banya and Sonia and Masha and Spikes or 2013 Tony Award win for Best Play. So that's the clip of me fidgeting on stage, and people ask me, why were you fidgeting? I actually was pinching myself because I could not believe my luck. You know, that I was the second, and we had, Leia and I, we had a 22-year gap. And for your information, by the way, there's a third Filipino who won the Tony, Clint Ramos, who won the costume for Eclipse, that starred Luke.